Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Science fiction often is considered campy fun, but the stories tend to explore deeper themes of life, death, and what it means to be human. Those themes resonate as well as technology becomes more and more a part of our everyday lives and as concepts such as artificial intelligence advance. Two plays coming to the Wexner Center for the Arts at OSU this weekend take on these issues with robot and human actors sharing the stage. Sinandan Theater Company and Osaka University Robot Theater Project will present two plays. The first one is called Sayonara with an android on stage, and the other one, I Worker, with two robots on stage with both of them joining humans. Joining us now to discuss the productions is Chuck Helm. He's director of the performing arts at OSU's Wexner Center for the Arts. Welcome to the show, Chuck.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for asking me to come on the show this morning.
This production is from Japan, where robots are more commonplace, I guess. Is it going to surprise Americans more than Japanese audiences?
I just think, well, there's certainly the novelty side of this, but I mean, yes, I think in Japan, I mean, they're so invested in sophisticated technology as part of their daily lives and in the development of robots and all different phases of robots. And with this particular group of performances, I think this aspect of what's known as social robots will come to the fore as we see how they're integrated into our daily lives. And we have these social relationships with robots.
You know, one of the reasons why robots aren't commonplace in this country is they're not cheap. They're very, very expensive. Where did they come from for this production?
Well, I think, I mean, in some ways, we do actually do have a lot of robots. I mean, many people have Siri on their iPhones that they converse with on a regular basis, et cetera, and different kinds of things. But this particular kind of robots, yes, they're not cheap, but they are becoming more common. And I think in particularly in this show with the robots here called iWorker, the idea of domestic robots as maids to help you in the house, it's something that's definitely a growing trend in Japan and starting to be in other parts of the world.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're marrying the arts and technology today with Chuck Helm. He's director of performing arts for the Wexner Center for the Arts at Ohio State University. If you have a question or comment about the upcoming productions by Sinandan Theater Company and Osaka University Robot Theater Project, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So there are two plays. In one, a human-like android is used, and in the other, as you mentioned, a pair of robot maids are used, and they look like maids would if they were a robot, I guess.
Right.
Both are said to elicit empathy, and I was wondering, how do you think they achieve this?
Well, I think it's this sort of reciprocity in their relationships with humans and how, you know, these robots are being now designed to embody human characteristics and values, and that sort of engenders this kind of idea that we should reciprocate with them as they almost were like people, and that they have this kind of helpful role in these people's daily lives that even amplifies that relationship. So, and it's also in sort of like this evolution of robots, like the domestic robots. They're almost like also an embodiment of what's in Japan now called cute culture, where they're sweet. And so they have these kind of characteristics. And I think that's one of the things that I think people will see in this theater productions is sort of how much empathy you have for these machines.
What is the story with the two robot maids?
Well, they're basically, I mean, as the title is, I Worker, they're designed to work, but the male in the couple that own the robots, he's got a very ambivalent attitude towards his own job and why am I working? And so a lot of the drama revolves around these kind of juxtapositions of this, you know, work is the fulfillment of who you are, as the robot believes, and his kind of like, I don't really want to get up and get out of bed kind of idea. So it has a lot to do with that.
And one of the robots can't work anymore.
Well, I think you're referring more about the android human thing.
Oh, okay.
The android human, there is a part where the android, that one is a little bit more of a philosophical thing about life and death, but the android, yeah, it has to be repaired. But one of the scenes that they added in recently was after the tsunami and the Fukushima nuclear plant disaster, when the robot is repaired. I mean, the android is repaired. It's repaired specifically so it can go into a damaged nuclear reactor and help there.
Why were you interested in bringing this production to Columbus?
Well, for several years, I've been part of a panel run by the Japan Foundation of New York, which is about exchanges between Japanese artists and U.S. artists. And I've had an opportunity to go to Japan a few times to some performing arts marketplaces. And it was there I saw a discussion by the theater director of Senandan Theater Company, a guy named Ariza Hirata. And he was talking about this collaboration with the Osaka University robot program on this thing, and I just thought it was fascinating how he talked about in the videos that he showed. And then also a friend of mine at Japan Society in New York who are organizing this tour had seen one of the shows and thought it was terrific, and so I was more than happy to sort of join forces and bring it here as well on this U.S. tour.
Does the juxtaposition of technology and art come up often?
I think increasingly.
Yeah.
Yes, very much so. But in this kind of form of theater that Senandan does, where it's really this emphasis on sort of like commonplace daily life, that's a little new thing for the Japanese in particular. I mean, a lot of times you see technology in theater as kind of a way of creating, media spectacle, mm-hmm. and these kinds of, very kind of explosive outward, going kinds of ideas on stage. But whereas this one is really kind of drawn in and intimate, it's a little different emphasis.
Yeah, when you refer to the Senandan style, is it the quiet theater?
That's what he's known as, a pioneer of what they call quiet theater, so that it's really not about trying to create these kinds of, it's looking for the sort of the subtle telling details in life rather than kind of like the big gesture.
How do the robots actually work? Are there puppeteers operating them? How does that work?
Yes, there are. They have certain things that are programmed into them, but then they're cued by their operators, and then they're also adjusted in performance by their operators. So, yes, they're almost like robotic puppets.
I'd love to talk to the actors who perform with the robots and wonder what we know about what their experience is like on stage.
Well, I think that, they work closely with these engineers at Osaka University to kind of, learn about the capacities of these robots and the android and what they can do and what their limits are. And in fact, one of the reasons why they're two short plays is the battery life on them is limited to a half an hour. So the theater company had to make sure that they were completely done before their bow, because that was it. They're going to run out of juice.
I was going to ask you, what are the technical difficulties in a production like this? I guess that would be it, right?
That's a big limitation. Of course, yeah, they have to, really test them out thoroughly in the exact spaces each time. But we try to keep the consistent conditions while they tour. But there's always that anxiety when they pull them out of their crates. Did they make it okay?
From the pictures I saw of the android, it's hard to see because it's sort of from the back.
Mm-hmm.
What does the android look like?
Very human.
Creepy?
Well, it's just sort of, it's like an automated mannequin almost in some ways. It's slightly eerie about how human it is. And again, I think that these are these attempts to try to create this more of a kind of a reciprocal relationship and with these, machines in our lives and the comfort zone around how we interact with these machines.
Does it seem to make much of a difference in the tenor of the conversations on stage between whether it's the maid robots that look like something from the Jetsons and this android?
There is a slight difference, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's in Japanese with subtitles, right?
Correct.
How will that work?
Well, we just, we just project the surtitles like they do, like in the opera these days or what have mm-hmm. you, so, or going to a foreign film in a different language, so... I think people will find it quite easy to follow along. It's been designed that way.
I read, though, that one of the, I think it's in Sayonara, isn't the actress American?
Yes, actually, that show's in English.
Okay.
Only I Workers in Japanese with the English subtitles.
And what will they sound like?
I actually haven't, seen these shows myself. I just saw brief video clips, but, they just, they speak in sort of like, a Japanese voice, like friendly and we're here to do what you need to do, to done. Or...
All right. Well, can you tell us a little bit about how long the run is, and is it going to be at the Mershon? Or
no, this is in our Black Box performance space at the Wexner Center. Mm-hmm. So we open Thursday night, and we have three shows Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Right now, we only have tickets available on Friday and Saturday, but we're considering if we have an uptick in sales that we'll maybe add a matinee on Saturday as well at 2. But that right now, we only have the three shows scheduled.
Okay, well, we'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Chuck Helm, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Nice talking with you, Ann.
Chuck Helm is the Director of Performing Arts for the Wexner Center for the Arts at Ohio State University. We've been talking about the Sinoden Theater Company and Osaka University Robot Theater Project. They're going to present two plays coming up this weekend, Sayonara with an android on stage and I Worker with two robots on stage. If you have any questions or comments, you can check out that link at our website again at WOSU.org. Coming up, we're going to hear from a couple a pair of developers. They have come up with a popular and successful new app, a goal of many developers out there. So stay tuned and you can hear all about it. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
To see a neighborhood in decline is one thing. To own a house in such a neighborhood is entirely another.
I think that I had judged people who had these vacant homes sitting in all kinds of stages of disrepair. But now I understand exactly how expensive it is to demolish a home.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the very expensive fight against blight. Next time on Marketplace from APN.
Marketplace tonight at 6 on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. 57 degrees in downtown Columbus. We're going to warm up today to a high near 65. Rain is likely tonight with a low right around 57 degrees. Showers and possibly a thunderstorm on Wednesday with a high of 61. Temperatures will fall throughout the day, though, bringing a chance of rain and snow Wednesday night, a low of 25. Support comes from the Wellington School, where children are encouraged to discover and develop their unique potential in preschool through grade 12. Wellington will host a prospective family visit day on Wednesday, January 30th from 9 to 11 a.m. More at wellington.org. And support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Everyone gets a bright idea every once in a while, an idea for an invention perhaps. But there is a big difference between that idea and bringing the concept to fruition, starting a company and getting the product out there. And in the exploding world of app development, the difference can be even greater with so much competition for attention. Joining us now are two entrepreneurs who have beaten the odds, the co-founders of Pushpins. Peter Michalaitis, he is CMO of Pushpins and a 2007 graduate of Ohio State University. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
Also with us is Jason Gerwin. He's CEO of Pushpins. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thanks very much.
First of all, tell us about Pushpins, the app itself. Tell us what it does. Peter, can you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Pushpins, the mobile app, what we do is we deliver targeted grocery coupons to users when they're in the aisles of a store. So the idea behind Pushpins is to be able to do a lot of what you'll see with programs like Google AdWords, where we can say, hey, we know a consumer is interested in a specific product by a variety of metrics, and say, hey, what would happen if we deliver, you know, a targeted grocery coupon to this user and see if we can convert them at that moment of truth when they're really debating what they want to buy and see if we can influence their shopping behavior. So the way Pushpins, the app, works is we'll allow a couple different ways for a user to use the app. One is, you know, you've got this sort of grocery shopping mom who's a bit of a planner. The way she'll use Pushpins is she'll download her application and she'll use it to organize her shopping list. So she'll build a full shopping list. She'll be able to browse through product information, nutrition information, ingredients, pick the products she wants to buy. She can browse through a recipe searcher, pick the recipes that she might want to cook that week, and build basically a full list for a shop. So let's say she's going to go shopping at Giant Eagle. She'll be able to build her full Giant Eagle shop. And while she's generating her shopping list, what we'll do is we'll show her all the relevant offers that we've gone out and sourced for her. So we'll have coupons, let's say, for, you know, General Mills Cheerios. And if she's got General Mills Cheerios on her list, she'll see that obviously show up, as well as if she's just got, like, related products. Like, if she's shopping for Chex, we might not have a coupon for Chex this week, but if we have one for Cheerios, we'll display that coupon. And so she'll see it directly on her phone. She can click the link for the coupon. And what we do is we tie into the point-of-sale system so that the coupon will come off automatically right at the register. So right when you swipe your Giant Eagle Advantage card, the money, the $3 or $5 that you save with Pushpins, will all come off right at the register.
Okay, so it's all connected to your card, your Giant Eagle card or your Kroger card or whatever it is.
Exactly. So, like, our way to identify a user and to know that they're at the store is through their Giant Eagle loyalty card, whichever shopping card they're using. And so that's our integration into point of sale. So, like, all you have to do, you don't even have to have the phone open at the store. All you have to do is go to the register like you normally do, swipe your Giant Eagle card, and you're going to get all the discounts that you would have gotten normally from, you know, just the Advantage Club. But then you also get the $5 Unilever products and, you know, $10 for P&G products that we've gone out and sourced for you, as long as you've identified intent to buy those products. So, you know, you built your shopping list and you've redeemed your coupon.
Are these new coupons or are they ones that you generated for this app?
Yeah, so both the same thing here.
Okay.
So they're new coupons that we've gone out and we sold for our application specifically. So what we've done is, like, I've worked with Unilever, I've worked with P&G, I've worked with all these different brands,
mm-hmm.
and I've gone out and said, hey, you know, we have this mobile app and we have this strategy where we think we can influence your guys as shoppers better than you're doing it currently with paper. And so we go out and we sell them these coupon campaigns and we'll bring in new inventory of coupons into our application. And then these are coupons that we can display to our users. So most of our coupons are found exclusively in our application. Now, something we've done to sort of give back to the users is we also bring in all the circular deals. So just to give them a lot of relevant information, right? So, like, we'll show them, and we make a clear distinction between what a circular offer is and what a coupon is, but we show them all the offers that are available for their loyalty card. So both the things that they would get anyways, as well as the items that we've gone out and sourced coupons for.
So, Jason, are you guys coupon clippers? Is that how you got this idea? Where did it come from?
You know, it's funny. I think you can't start a coupon company if you're not cheap. But I wouldn't say we were, you know, the traditional coupon clippers day one. I think when Peter and I really started this company, we wanted to take what we saw was a pretty big problem. You know, there's 285 billion of these paper coupons delivered every year. It's bad for the environment. It's difficult for the consumer to remember to actually bring them to the store. So what we really wanted to do is make it simple for them. So, you know, what Pushpins really is, it's your grocery shopping assistant, right? You can do everything from planning to clipping, and we really wanted to make it easy. And it's actually pretty interesting. I think, you know, when we started this, we thought we'd get, you know, thousands and thousands of shoppers who are those extreme couponers. But when in fact, you know, we also get a lot of people who've never clipped a coupon before in their life, but we've made it so easy for them to save with the app that, you know, it's just a simpler way of doing it.
Did you work together on this idea? I'm kind of trying to get at the idea of how you develop an app in the first place, how it works.
Yeah, so Peter and I actually were classmates at Harvard Business School, and, you know, we had both started companies in the past. I started a company in the entertainment space. Peter actually used to build point-of-sale systems. So, you know, when we were looking at what we wanted to do next, we sort of were looking for markets where we could take a lot of the lessons we learned, myself around analytics, Peter around point-of-sale. So we started sort of stumbling onto the coupon market. And then ultimately, over the next year or so, we had built out sort of a prototype of the application with the rest of our technical team. We moved out from Boston to Silicon Valley, and we're part of this amazing fellowship program where they gave you funding and office space and didn't actually take any equity. So we were able to build the first version of our application and sort of prove that this actually worked. And after we did that, we ended up raising venture capital and started growing the company sort of organically.
Did you find that moving out to Silicon Valley was necessary to do what you wanted to do or just helpful?
I would say that there are things that it's helpful for and there's things that it's not. I think, you know, it's incredibly helpful to network you with investors and, you know, engineers and finding, you know, other like-minded people. But, you know, we were in Boston for over a year where I would say there's not as much of a tech community. And I think there's pros and cons of both, right? You know, there's something nice about being the big fish in the small pond versus, you know, in Silicon Valley where, you know, you go down to the local bar and every single person is telling you about their startup. So I think there's definitely pros and cons of both.
Yeah, and I think to add a little bit more color to the whole Silicon Valley mentality, like one of the big advantages out here for us, and as you guys, as a lot of people have seen through reading our articles, is we were able to do a lot and a little, right? So we raised a small amount of capital and we were able to build this business to fruition. And the reason for that is just the types of resources that are available, right? Like Pushpin's literally had free office space from inception to the point of when we sold the company. So this is, you know, we were hosted in a variety of different buildings, but I mean, we spent over a year of our lives inside of AOL's businesses, along with another 30 different startups that were there. And this is just something they do to give back to the community, right? Like let entrepreneurs build ideas, build cool things, and keep an eye on sort of what's happening in tech. And so that's something that's hard to replicate in other places and something that Silicon Valley does really well. And it's one of the real reasons that it drew us out there.
If you have a question or comment, I'm talking with the co-founders of Pushpins, Jason Gerwin and Peter Michaelides. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, post your question or comment there, or you can tweet us at WOSU. All sides. When the app was up and running, who did the job of updating it, of continuing to make it relevant? How many people did you have working for you? How does that work?
Yeah, so we have a team of five working on the application, on the actual technical piece. So, you know, we have, you know, back-end engineer who works on the complete infrastructure that connects to the different point-of-sale systems and allows us to clip the coupon. You know, we have, you know, in-house mobile developers who actually build the application on iOS and upcoming on Android. So, you know, it's a collective team of, you know, both product managers, technical people. Peter leads our business development and sales. So it's not just one piece that makes this happen. There's a number of different, you know, elements to really bring the app to fruition.
Peter, how do you attract business to this? Is this the coupon, the companies, the grocery stores themselves, or is there an intermediary?
Yeah, so it's interesting that the sales model for us is actually a pretty difficult one. So if you think about what we do, right, we don't really have one specific customer because you could look at each of these different parties as our customer, right? Like our customer is the end user using our application. My customer is the brand that wants to advertise on my application. But then my customer is also ultimately the retailer, the one that I can deliver the coupon through and ultimately gives the discount to the consumer, right? So it's actually a bit of a hustle. Like this business is built off of sort of connecting each of these parties and showing them value. So showing value to a consumer by giving them money off at the register, showing value to a brand by targeting and delivering better advertisements than they can currently do on paper. And then ultimately to the retailer, our big sell to them is, hey, allow us access to the pipes, allow us access to your guys' point of sale system. And what we're going to do is we're going to bring consumers that have already showed intent to buy more products. And these are products that are obviously being subsidized by the brands themselves. So I'd like to say, you know, it's an easy sales process. You just get a bunch of consumers like something like a Facebook would do and then connect them to each other and let them go.
But in this case, there's a lot of parties that we sort of have to go through and line up. And so really what we've done is we've built a value prop on each of these different pieces to be able to prove that there's, you know, reason enough to download our app, reason enough to advertise with us, and then reason enough to allow us to integrate into your system.
Carol in Mansfield, you want to get down to the consumer point of view. Welcome to the show, Carol.
Good morning, Ann. My question is to the gentleman, do they suspect the grocer is going to build in the price of the coupon because they're making it so easy for us?
So I think, you know, what we see with the grocers, I think the grocers have one line of discounting. You know, in the grocery business, there's sort of shopper marketing dollars, and that's what brands spend to get the product discounted, better shelf placement, and things like that. That's sort of one channel to drive down ultimate price. But then on top of it, brands want to go outside of that element and really spend national brand dollars to get their brand out there past them. So, you know, ultimately, the best thing for the consumer is actually what ends up happening is you have the brand spending money on the retail side to drive down costs, and then the brand spending money outside of the retail channel to drive down costs. So it's sort of a win-win for the consumer on that side.
Carol?
I hope it's true.
Okay, thanks a lot. Well, so what kind of action do you have on this? How are you measuring success for the rest of us? How can we see how many people are following the app or use the app?
Yeah, so we have, you know, over 1 million downloads. We have a ton of shoppers using this every single month. You know, what we've really found is, you know, the best way to actually see it in action is to use it yourself. I think what you'll find is, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, it's very easy for us to say we're making grocery shopping simpler, but, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, we really try to take all the different elements of grocery shopping and make it easier, from planning your list to finding recipes to clipping coupons. You know, we want to be that grocery shopping.
Well, how did you test drive this thing? Because you mentioned you're not necessarily the typical coupon clippers, and I'm just going to make a stab at this and imagine you're not the typical grocery shoppers either.
So, pretty fortunate for us. You know, we do have moms that use our application all the time. So, you know, it's nice to be able to hear all the complaints. I think, you know, a couple months ago, my mom sent an email to her iPhone developer telling to change this. So, you know, there's nothing better than getting that organic feedback. Right.
Boy,
actually, another thing that's interesting is if you actually look, when we take a breakdown of our demographics and sort of who uses our application, partly because of who built this app, you know, a couple 25-year-old males, we see the second largest segment of our users being in that demographic. And the reason for that is because one of the things we allow our users to do is to just walk into the aisle, grab a product off the shelf. So, like, you can walk up to chips, scan the product like Frito-Lay's potato chips, and we're going to show you all the things in that aisle that are relevant. So we'll show you Pepsi products. We'll show you all the different snack items that are in that aisle. And it's as easy as just clip the coupon, put the phone back in your pocket, go to the register, and pay. So interestingly enough, although we weren't going for this demographic when we built the app, because of who built it, it turns out that our second biggest segment of users is that.
Well, you struck gold then.
Yeah, fortunately that worked out. And then back to the user side, you were asking sort of like growth and how many people are using it.
Yeah.
Well, one of the big accomplishments for Pushpins recently, as you guys know, is that we were acquired by Performance Marketing Brands, which is the parent company of Ebates.com, mm-hmm. as well as FatWallet.com. And so one of the big advantages there is that we're going to be leveraging their 10 million monthly users to hit our application and to be able to show brands that, hey, we can really deliver content in a meaningful way to consumers.
Does this mean you're going to be working for Ebate now and not developing apps anymore? Or what does this mean about your future as app developers?
Yeah, so for us, you know, nothing will really change on the Pushpin side in terms of, you know, development. If nothing else, for our consumers, that means we'll be able to, you know, accelerate growth a ton. So, you know, we've already started building on other platforms like Android and web mm-hmm. to bring the entire Pushpins experience to anywhere you shop, you know, and, you know, ultimately it will help us bring additional coupons to the app as well. You know, we're working now with, you know, our larger parent to sort of drive more and more brands to advertise and promote and deliver coupons in the application. So, you know, for us, you know, it was sort of a win-win from the sense that, you know, we'll be able to stick on our vision of making grocery shopping easy, mm-hmm. but at the same time be able to leverage the resources of a pretty large company.
So you're working on an Android app then?
Correct, yep.
Okay. What is your advice to other would-be app developers? There are a lot of people out there that don't have the resources you did that are trying to make a go of it. How do you recommend they do that?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of things you can do as sort of an independent app developer in order to just get started. You know, I think we were pretty fortunate that we were in school, so we had access to business plan competitions. We actually, you know, won our first $5,000 to build a prototype, winning a business plan competition. But, you know, these exist everywhere. I think, you know, the nice thing about, you know, startups being hip and cool again is you see all these contests, right? So you're able to sort of test your vision, get sort of your idea out there, get feedback from both users but also other smart people, you know, in the competition, right? You're able to pitch to venture capital firms, you know, and other entrepreneurs and professors and all things like that. So that would be my first advice, is sort of get out there. The second is, like, don't be afraid to fail. You know, I think everyone goes into this thinking that they're going to be the next Facebook, but, you know, very few companies end up being that. Be willing to take chances. Be willing to put everything on the line, because, you know, if you don't, you're not going to succeed. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that you can do just from your mindset in order to make things happen.
What?
Yeah, and I think the final piece for apps specifically, right?
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing with software is it's pretty easy to launch. It's pretty easy to get going, right? So, like, you can look at, I mean, our iPhone developer who joined us, he joined us at 18 years old. He's 21 now, and he's launched a number of significant applications, one of which ended up on the TV series The Big Bang Theory as, you know, just a fun whip app. And this is something, you know, he launched into the market, could have gone nowhere, but it was a good trial for him to see, you know, what is it like building games and things that are a little bit more fun versus, you know, grocery shopping apps that he was working with us. And he launches this app in the marketplace, it gets picked up by a TV show, and all of a sudden becomes an overnight success.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, like, you kind of have to prepare yourself to sort of get lucky. And this stuff happens out there.
I was going to ask you, were you guys ever interested in the game app business, or were you always looking for something more like this?
I think we were always looking for more, you know, productivity lifestyle tool. You know, I think the game market is a very, very competitive market. It's very hard to rise above the noise versus other games out there, you know, especially with pretty large players. You know, it's really a hits-driven business. You see guys like Zynga, the reason, mm-hmm. you know, they're so successful is they can have one successful game and they'll launch their second successful game off of that first one. So, you know, we try to stay out of the game market.
Yeah, and I guess also, like, Jason and I both sort of the skills that we possessed as like biz dev and business people here, a lot of it was that hustle that we were talking about earlier, the ability to just get on the phone, cold call the CEO of a company, get them to respond to us. that's a major thing, and not a lot of people have that. And so we've decided, okay, since we have this skill set, let's focus on that, less so on, you know, like the fun gaming, that kind of stuff.
Well, congratulations on your success.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And thanks a lot for talking to us today.
It was great talking to you. It was a long time.
Jason Gerwin, co-founder, and his other co-founder, Peter Michalaitis, of Pushpins. Coming up, we're going to be talking about some gadgets with Troy Wolverton, tech columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how the U.S. military came to embrace counterinsurgency as an approach to the fighting in Iraq and why it's failed in Afghanistan. We'll talk with journalist and historian Fred Kaplan, author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow for a history of the Second Amendment and its application in modern society. And then it's Wellness Wednesday and a discussion of concussions in retired football players and curbing the effects of bad breath. That's Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. Cloudy skies today, but a high near 65 degrees. Rain tonight, a low of 57. Support comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, performing with the Columbus Youth Jazz Orchestra in Ragtime Blues and Beyond, a short history of jazz, with guest saxophonist Tina Fuller and drummer Lewis Nash, showcasing over 100 years of jazz February 7th through the 10th at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org. And support comes from the Columbus Symphony, taking the stage with the Columbus Symphony Chorus and guest soprano Jillian Keith in a program featuring Mozart and Haydn. Friday and Saturday, February 1st and 2nd at the Ohio Theater. Details and tickets at columbussymphony.com. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday. The cameras on our smartphones are getting better and better, and that has camera manufacturers worried that consumers will abandon the devices that are only cameras. But not everyone is convinced that's the case. In fact, our next guest says he's in the market for a new camera. Joining us now to discuss the smartphone cameras and other tech news is Troy Wolverton. He's a tech columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Welcome to the show, Troy.
Hi, glad to be here, Ann.
So in a recent column, you provide a litany of reasons why the smartphone camera, in your case, the iPhone, works wonders. What works about the phone camera?
Well, there are lots of reasons why people like using their smartphone cameras. You know, first of all, the device tends to be with them all the time. I mean, I don't always carry around my digital camera, either my DSLR or point-and-shoot camera. But I always have my smartphone with me. So in a pinch, if I need to take a picture, I've got my smartphone with me. And, you know, it tends to be much easier to share photos from your smartphone than it does from a digital camera. You know, you've got built-in connectivity in your your smartphone, so you can instantly share it on Facebook, you can email photos to friends, you can send them via instant messenger or through messaging programs, text messaging programs. So it's pretty easy to share, and plus with all the apps that are out there these days, you can do all kinds of great things with your pictures. You can, you know, make them look retro or turn them into black and white photos or, you know, add art to them or whatever, things that you just would have to import your pictures into a computer from a digital camera, you know, to do something similar. It's a much more difficult or much timelier process, it takes more time to do it with your digital camera.
Yeah, which made me wonder, why don't the digital camera makers make that easier to do? And you mentioned a Samsung model that has built-in Wi-Fi, which would be the answer to my dreams, eliminating that step of removing the card from the camera. But why don't the camera makers make all of those options possible?
Well, they're starting to.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the Samsung camera. There are several cameras that are on the market now that have Wi-Fi built into them, and there are likely to be more that are coming up. And, you know, the first iterations of Wi-Fi and cameras actually came from, there was a company called iFi that had Wi-Fi that was built into one of their SD cards, the memory card that you plug into your camera. Mm-hmm. And really the first iterations of this were that the pictures would automatically transfer from your camera to your computer or your camera up to a photo service up on in the cloud up on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening now is that the Wi-Fi connectivity is giving people more options. And so instead of having the pictures transferred to your computer or transferred to the cloud, you could have them transferred to your smartphone so that you can instantly start doctoring up those photos on your smartphone, or you can then share them on all your social networks pretty quickly. So they go, you know, maybe to your camera's photo gallery program. And then, you know, camera makers are taking one more step beyond just putting Wi-Fi into their cameras. They are now starting to create cameras that have Android in them, the operating system that's in many smartphones today. And what that allows is that you can use the same kind of photo apps that you use on your smartphone, you can now use on these Android-powered cameras so that they work, you know, they're almost like a smartphone, except that they don't necessarily make phone calls, but they can do all the same kind of cool things. And those cameras, I think, have Wi-Fi. And I think in some cases, they actually do have 3G or 4G connectivity into them so that you can use them even if you don't have a Wi-Fi connection.
My guest is Troy Wolverton. He's a tech columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check us out on Facebook or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. Do you ever see a day, though, when they're going to have the good enough camera for you on a phone, or they just don't make them that big, or it would make...
Yeah, you know, as I wrote in my column, as much as I love my iPhone camera, and I use my iPhone all the time to take pictures. In fact, you know, I was just in San Francisco over the weekend with my son, and he and I were taking pictures with that camera. And when I went to the Consumer Electronics Show earlier this month, I only took along my iPhone, and all the pictures that I took there were all on my iPhone. But you know, there are downsides to using a smartphone. There are things you don't get from a smartphone that you do get from a dedicated digital camera. So, you know, one of the things is that smartphones don't generally offer optical zoom lenses.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to zoom in on something, you can with a smartphone, but it's a digital zoom, and all you're really doing is just, you know, cropping the picture and kind of blowing up the area that within the picture. You're not using an actual zoom lens. And the difference is significant. Like, you just, the picture is not clear when you zoom in on it. You get lots of noise when you do a digital zoom. Whereas, you know, the average digital camera these days, you know, even a low-end one will give you a 5x optical zoom. And, you know, you don't have to pay that much more to get a 10x optical or even something as much as a 20 or a 50x optical zoom. So you can really zoom in. And you know, if you're out there trying to take pictures of your kid on the soccer field, mm-hmm. or, you know, at a basketball game and trying to zoom in on the players or something, you just can't really do that on a smartphone. And you can on a dedicated digital camera. You know, the other thing is, and this kind of is dovetails with that, and that is that the sensors, the image sensor in a smartphone is much, much smaller than that in a typical digital camera, particularly if you're talking about like a DSLR camera. And why that matters is that the smaller the image sensor, the more noise you tend to get and the grainier the pictures tend to look. The larger it is, the wider apart, the further apart the pixels can be and the image elements can be. And so you're able to get less noise in the picture and you're able to get a much higher fidelity picture than you do on a smaller image sensor. And, you know, given how small smartphones are, you just can't get a big image sensor. I mean, not only how small they are in terms of, you know, how thin and how long, but, you know, the distance between the lens that you're shooting through and the image sensor is very small. And so you just can't, there's not enough room there to put in a big image sensor. And there is in a digital camera. And so you get much higher fidelity shots, much, much better looking shots, particularly when you're zooming in with a digital camera. I mean, a dedicated digital camera.
Desmond in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. And this is the first time I got to call in since you've been on.
Well, thank you.
I had a question for the gentleman. What type of DSLR do you use?
I have a Canon, and I'm going to hopefully pronounce this right. It's a 60D. I actually miswrote that as a D60, I think, in my column. But it's a Canon 60D, which is like a prosumer camera. I think it costs somewhere around $900 or $1,000 just for the camera body,
right.
And then you buy the lenses extra.
Because I shoot with the T3i, and I noticed the T4i just came out, of course, after I bought the T3i. But the T4i has the Wi-Fi capabilities built in. I found the card with the antiquated. It's like played out now with the iFi, but it was transferring the pictures like snail pace slow. I can mail them to my computer faster.
Yeah.
I'm finding, though, as I'm a professional photographer, but when I go out to clubs or events, it used to be the cameraman would make a lot of money or make a decent amount of money, but now you have people standing around with their phones trying to be pro-consumers, I guess. I don't know what you would call it, but it's messing up the professional photographer market with what they're putting in the smartphone.
Well, except that if people depend on those for the kind of quality pictures you want from a wedding or a special event, they're going to be sadly disappointed, don't you think, Troy?
True.
I definitely think that. But especially if you know, if it's an indoor event, one of the things that happens is that smartphones, because of their small sensors, don't do very well in low-light conditions, mm-hmm. whether that's indoor or at night. And so the pictures you can take with a DSLR, particularly if you've got a flash on it, are going to be far superior to what you can get on a smartphone in those kinds of conditions.
True.
And not to mention the fact that composition and all the stuff you've learned how to do, Desmond, no competition. But thanks for your call. Thanks for listening.
Sure. Thank you.
All right.
Sure, but bye-bye. I had to laugh about his comment about the iFi. I actually tested out an iFi card, I don't know, a couple of years ago. My wife actually bought one for me, and I had the same experience. I didn't understand why someone would want one of those iFi cards, because I could upload the pictures. You know, I could probably upload, you know, two or three times the number of pictures and the amount of time it would take for it to upload all the pictures from the iFi card, and it was draining the battery at the same time.
Right. Yeah. So what do you recommend at this point? Do you have any ideas for listeners?
In terms of actual cameras?
Yeah.
You know, I haven't reviewed individual camera models. I chose my the DSLR that we have, which I actually bought for my wife. I chose in part because my father and my brother-in-law and my father-in-law all have Canons. And so if you're in the market for a DSLR, it's not a bad idea to see what your friends and family members have, because the cost of those lenses is a whole lot. I mean, you can spend as much on a lens or more on a lens than you can on just the camera body. And so, you know, my thought going in was it would be great to have a camera in which I could swap lenses with my family members and not have to go into that full investment just by myself. So that was really a serious thought when I was thinking about it. And then in terms of, you know, I think I said in the column that, and you mentioned earlier, that I'm in the market for a point-and-shoot digital camera. I actually bought one for my son, not this Christmas, but the previous Christmas, and we got a Sony CyberShot, and it was a nice little camera. I think I spent $150 or something on it, and it was amazing to me just how nice that camera was. Unfortunately, it was stolen right before Christmas this year, so that's why I'm in the market for another one. And I'm likely, I don't know, there's a good chance I'll replace it with another Sony CyberShot. Unfortunately, the model that I bought has been discontinued, so I'm still kind of trying to figure out which one we're going to get.
Did you lose a lot of pictures?
or
is that
wait,
bringing
that's
up,
a
is
source.
That picking a scab for you?
That's a sore subject, yeah.
Okay.
you know, as a tech columnist, you know, one of the things that, that tech columnists do is they preach about backup, I had many things backed up, but I did not have all my pictures backed up.
I'm sorry.
And so that's it is a sore subject. I'm quite unhappy about that.
All right, let's move to a happier subject: Apple's growth outlook. It's been a sure thing for a long time. Couldn't go wrong with Apple. The iPad had a lot to do with that, but the growth has dropped a lot. Tell us about what's happening with Apple.
So Apple, as recently as, I don't know, 2 years, 18 months ago, Apple was growing phenomenally fast. I mean, you know, there are very few companies that grow their sales at 50% or greater on an annual basis. And there are almost no companies the size of Apple, and we're talking about a company that has over $100 billion in sales every year, that grow that fast.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple was growing, you know, there were some quarters there where it was growing 70%, 80% quarter over quarter, and its earnings were growing, you know, more than 100%. It was just phenomenal growth. And what was fueling that was a huge uptake in sales of the iPhone, and a huge uptake in the iPad. You know, they launched the iPad in January of 2010. I think it actually came out in March of 2010. And it just sold like gangbusters. And what's happening now is that I think in its most recent quarter, Apple grew at about 17%. I think that's the third time in a row that it's grown at less than 30% on a revenue side. But more importantly, its earnings didn't grow at all. Its earnings were basically the same as the year before. And going forward in this current quarter that it's in, Apple itself predicted that its earnings, the implication from its guidance, which was a little bit kind of unclear, was that its earnings were actually going to drop significantly in this coming quarter. And what's happening with Apple is that it's in a transition period, a real transition. And it's in a transition from a company that had a couple of new, very fast-growing products to a company that hasn't, that still has those products, but they're not growing as fast as before. And a company that hasn't found a new, for want of a better analogy, another leg on the stool. There's nothing else there's no new growth engine for Apple that would replace the growth that it was getting from the iPhone or from the iPad. What's worse for Apple, and the reason why its earnings are dropping, is that it is trading now sales of some of its higher priced, higher profit items for items that are lower priced and lower profit. Most notably, people are trading, stopping. They're no longer buying as many Macs. They're buying iPads.
In other words, it's cannibalizing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So they're not. And now what seems to be happening is not only are they buying iPads instead of Macs, now it seems like they're buying iPad minis, the new small iPad, instead of the full iPad. And the problem for Apple is that the iPad mini in particular, Apple has said, is significantly less profitable than the company average. So the average product that Apple sells makes a lot more money after paying for all its costs than it does on the iPad mini. And so you've got not only a product that sells for far less than the full-size Mac or the iPad. The iPad mini starts at $330. The full-size iPad starts at $500. The Mac started about $1,000. So, you're selling an iPad mini at $330 versus a Mac at $1,000. But its profit on that, on a percentage basis, is much less than you would get on the Mac or the iPad. So what that means is that you've got to sell a whole lot of those iPad minis to make up for the lost sales and particularly the lost profits on the Mac or the big iPad. And so, what's happening, Apple's, again, their revenue actually grew in this quarter. It grew 17%, but their sales were flat. I mean, their earnings were flat. And so that's, it's kind of in this transition where it's the types of products it's selling are changing, and it's cannibalizing its own sales. Now, Apple would say that it would rather that Apple itself cannibalize its sales mm-hmm. than another company. And there's wisdom in that. You'd rather see some sales and some profit rather than having it all go over to Samsung or one of your other competitors.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't make the process any easier. And it kind of points out that the competitive pressures that Apple is under. You can believe that if Apple that Apple must not be happy, they can't be happy about trading in high profits for lower profits, and that it had all kinds of competition. You've got the Kindle Fire that was coming in at $200. You've got the Nexus 7 that was coming in at $200. You've got the Nook tablet that's like $200, $250. It was under intense pressure to start to release a lower priced iPad. And it's got all kinds of pressure on the iPhone or on the smartphone side too. I mean, smartphone sales, the iPhone sales were up, but they weren't growing as fast as they had before.
Well,
and Apple's market share is slipping.
Well, I'd still like to be Apple, but that's another conversation for another day. Troy Wolverton, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Troy Wolverton, tech columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday. Thanks to the All-Side staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Corinne Gleckler. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.